Hello, and welcome to the CEO.Digital Show. Our previous season on responsible AI showed us that no disruption comes without both opportunities and threats. With the digital sector's carbon emissions set to double in 2024 alone, the catastrophic effects of climate change will be our most challenging disruption yet. The World Health Organization estimates that 3.6 billion people will bear the brunt of that disruption, with the most vulnerable among us at the greatest risk. Grassroots action is an important part of the search for a solution, but the heaviest responsibility lies with governments, businesses, and tech leaders to combine their efforts and innovate against the climate crisis. We're gathering expert perspectives regarding the tech world's impact on impending climate change and how those same innovations might help forge a more sustainable future for us all. Beginning with today's guest.
My name is Dr. Victoria Hirth, and I am an independent pracademic.
Focused most recently on assisting organisations in making impactful decisions that promote long-term well-being for all, Dr. Hirth's work emphasises the importance of quality governance as a key driver for change, in addition to purpose, marketing, leadership, and culture. Among her many accomplishments is co-leadership of the development of ISO 37000, the first ever global standard on governance for organisations. Additionally, she is chair of the International Advisory Board that steers the Institute for Sustainability, a Cambridge course designer and tutor on sustainability in marketing, media and creative, and a leading event speaker on methodologies and frameworks for achieving large-scale sustainability goals. And so now, Dr. Victoria Hirth, let me welcome you to the CEO.Digital Show. You describe yourself as a pracademic. What exactly do you mean by that, and why is that such an important distinction to make?
Well, for me, we really have to try our best to sit somewhere right in the very uncomfortable place between theory and practice. Because if we go to the extreme ends of being one or the other, to be an academic can therefore often mean to be creating theory, but that theory to be abstracted from the dynamic reality in which that theory is then applied. So it then becomes pretty useless, certainly pretty useless in the context of making the world a better place, you know, which, so I very much come from the sort of pragmatism school, which means that, you know, you really have to question why you're asking the things you're asking in research and building the theories you're building. It has to have some use. But on the other hand, if we are sitting in practice and not building theory, then essentially what we're doing is meeting every situation as if it was a new situation and just doing what intuitively maybe or instinctively seems right. Now, if we're masters in that context, as we know from Daniel Kahneman's work, maybe we'll be able to do that well. But in general, contexts need more deliberate thinking through. And the process of theory building is merely just saying, oh, you know what, I'm noticing patterns in things. And so if I was to summarize those patterns in a way that means that next time I approach a situation or somebody else does, that they can sort of start a few stages ahead and save some time and make some better decisions. So really, we can't do either theory or practice on its own. We have to be somewhere in the middle. And so for me, that's just a way of expressing that very formally in myself. And because I've spent a lot of time very deliberately in an applied context in the world of practice, and also very deliberately in the world of academia. And I try and oscillate and bridge the two spheres, you might say.
Fantastic answer. Yes. And this idea of definitions and defining different things and making sure that everyone understands, for example, what is sustainable and what is not sustainable, how you even get people to agree on all of that. But why is it so difficult sometimes to just get all of the key decision makers in any regarding any challenge to just even agree on the key terminology?
I think the first thing to note is that the focal question of my inquiry over the, well, probably 30 odd years has really been, how do we align organizational decision making with a sustainable future? And so that does require being really clear about what we mean, or what I feel is meant by a sustainable future, what's meant by organizations, what's meant by organizational decision making. Because if you're thinking that something means one thing and someone's thinking it means another, which is what happens in most everyday conversations, you know, yes, it can build rapport, you can build relationships, because you are not digging into the fact that you might mean something completely different. When you're actually trying to solve really important and difficult problems, if you don't have that fundamental same starting position about what you really mean, then you're not clear what it is you're trying to solve. You're not clear what it is you think your key assumptions are. And so you just go around in circles. And that's why for me, and you will have noticed, I've spent a lot of my voluntary time in the standards building world. Essentially, in summary, it's because what caught of my theory of change is that we have the energy in the system. More and more people are feeling very concerned, rightly so, because they might not understand the underlying science, but they're starting to see the effects of the breakdown of our systems all around them. So that energy to change, to do something, to act is there. The solutions are even there. You know, we know basically pretty much everything that we, in terms of big scale solutions that we might employ, we know. The problem that we have is we don't have, I would say, three things: the clarity, the unity, and the confidence to move forward quickly. And those three things are interconnected. So to have confidence, in other words, to lead and to speak to the world, to others, to your colleagues, friends, you know, whatever, in a way that is different to what is normally spoken about, which is different to the normal assumptions in the world, takes courage. Because by default, if you're trying to create something new, you're trying to say that what is currently existing is not right. And that puts you at odds with the mainstream. But to have confidence, therefore, and that's why of many of the psychological theories, one of the most powerful is the theory around norms. Because if we feel we're not alone, we are much more confident to act and move forwards. So we need that unity in order to be able to supercharge the leadership that's needed. But we cannot get that unity unless we have clarity. So you can't unify around anything unless it's clear that that thing is something that you are unified in. And so you need that fundamental clarity. So it starts with being very, very precise, or as precise as you can be in a group in terms of the consensus about terms and definitions. And standards building essentially formalizes that process, gives you a time scale, ensures you have a hugely multi-stakeholder representative set of voices. I'm talking now about the national standards building processes and ISO, which is essentially the world's best multi-stakeholder consensus building process. That's really all that it is. And so that's a process that drives forward that clarity. So once you start the clock and you are trying to build a standard around any topic, the first thing you need to do is, are we all aligned around the fundamentals of this topic that we think we're trying to build a consensus around? And in doing that, therefore, you have to draw out of the woodwork people's assumptions, people's current definitions, and then try and understand where actually there might not be any difference because people are just using things in a slightly different way. Or maybe they're very early on the journey of understanding a concept, but if you take them through that journey, they go, oh yeah, no, that makes sense to me. So often there's a lot more consensus around definitions and things than we think there is. And on the other hand, we can draw out where maybe there are some fundamental differences of opinion. But normally those fundamental differences are based on overcomable realities, or they will ultimately be about an ideological perspective. And that's why consensus building is not about everybody agreeing on everything all the time. It is about saying, how strong is the sort of majority view? And it might be that a definition, maybe 60, 70% of people are like, yeah, that does it for me. maybe there are 30% that say, well, I can live with it. And you might get some that disagree, but you still can say that you have a good consensus. And then the process is, how do we improve that consensus over time? So standards and definitions are there always in working mode, just like in academic thinking. It's always about saying, can we improve this? Can we make it better? And that's why I also think it's so vital.
Wow. Yes. That clarity is really present in the way that you lay out everything that's at stake there. You referenced sort of passingly there ISO, and I'm aware that you were heavily involved with the development of ISO 37000, the governance benchmark. I was just wondering what you might like to tell our listeners about that project, as a lot of them will be thinking a lot about ISO requirements and 37000 for their own businesses.
Yeah, absolutely. 37000 is quite an unusually important ISO standard. I'm not saying that all the other ISO standards are not important. I'm sure they are. But ISO 37000 was different, I suppose. So in ISO world, so in terms of ISOs, they sort of started very much in the widget standardization. So let's make sure that all plugs, you know, are similar in certain ways to make to stop the friction between trade and communication, et cetera, et cetera. But a lot of times in terms of widgets and things. And then they moved into processes. So probably a lot of listeners work with the environmental management standards and the quality standards. So these were really groundbreaking ways of standardizing processes, important key processes. But ISO 37000 is governance of organizations. And so in moving from sort of widgets to processes, ISO then started looking much more in the sort of breaking ground at bigger sort of how do we really understand the nature of organizations and business? And we can think, for example, of 26000 on social responsibility as an example. And those would start to reference governance, because if you start to look at the whole organizational system and really at any part of the organization, you hit governance. Often it wasn't called governance, it was called something different. It might not have been called the governing body, but something different. But ISO was starting to hook into that. And so ISO 37000 was the time that the sort of grasped the nettle and said, right, are we able to, as a world, understand what we think governance of organizations is? So defining it and then defining what good practice in that is. And for many of the listeners that might not be so aware of governance as a topic, it's important to remember that while management is also a really new topic. I think a lot of us, we're plonked on planet Earth. We've got to kind of make sense of what's around us. I don't think a lot of us realize that management really only goes back to the, at best, early 1900s. There was some stuff in the mid 1800s, but really, and it really took off in the sort of 1950s, really. So really quite new. But governance as a discipline, whilst the fundamentals go back to Plato, you might say, as a discipline, it's much newer than management. And the sort of growing up of governance really happened within a business as usual mindset. In other words, the current way that we have decided we should organize the market economy. And this way is, of course, underpinning the unsustainability that we now see. And so being able to sort of break free from the sort of definitions and ideas of governance that were anchored to, say, stock exchange codes, where a lot of those ideas were embedded, which were really about protecting financial income for investors, which is at the heart of the business as usual paradigm. It was such a very big deal to then say, look, I think we're in a position that we can create a global standard that gets beneath and beyond that to say, you know, what fundamentally is governance, and governance for all organizations. So not just business, but also including business, but also governance of governance of charities, governance of any kind of organization you might imagine, and in any part of the world. And that's what ISO 37000 represents. So it really is important in terms of defining some of those key, at the beginning of standards, you always get the definitions. And I can tell the listeners that every single word in that ISO was debated at length. That the whole process took 5 years. There were 77 countries and 25 liaisons involved, and it was signed off in the end by 164 countries. There were over 2,000 very detailed comments that were resolved in a workshop environment with representatives from different countries, and those resolutions were then made public. So a very detailed process, and it really represents the new frontier. So any organization that is interested in doing governance well and making sure that they really understand governance, you know, ISO 37000 is the go-to. And all I can say in summary, and maybe we'll go into this in more detail, is that if we don't understand governance, then everything that we're talking about in terms of a sustainable future is just a nice idea. Because governance essentially structures and routinizes decision-making, and therefore routinizes and structures the outcomes and impacts in the world that we have.
Wow, yes. You've really hit on that link between sustainability and bad governance. I've heard you talk about it before, if you don't mind bringing it up again. Could you tug on that thread a little bit more for us, that connection of the governance issue at the heart of sustainability?
Yes, absolutely. I think you might be referring to the keynote I did at the European Organization for Quality just before the end of the year. And the title was, provocatively, but I completely stand by it, Why Unsustainability is One Big Governance Failure and Why Quality Governance Can Fix It. That's that sort of bold, clear conclusions I was talking about. So I'm trying not to sort of, if I feel very clear about something, not hold back in saying that, but at the same time say, hey, you know, as I always do, if not this, what? You know, I'm not saying I might not have missed loads of things, but please do tell me, because we all really need to know. So governance is absolutely fundamental. And I'm going to summarize ISO, the core of the 37,000, in about 2 minutes in order to make this clear, which I hope for listeners will be clear, is that in the definition of governance is essentially a human-based system that directs, accounts, and oversees an organization in relation to its stated purpose. So those three, that's not verbatim, but you can go to the standards to get the actual words, but that's what it is. So the three fundamental aspects there, and this is rooted in those sort of definitions of governance going back to the stock exchange codes, etc., and the Cadbury report and things like that, are direction and oversight. Now, the Cadbury report and others also talked about accountability, but it wasn't in the core definition, but that was elevated because it was seen to be absolutely fundamental. So if we just dig into that then, so governance is about clarity of direction. You then have to oversee that direction to see whether or not it's being achieved. And then you have to be accountable for whether or not it's being achieved with significant or stakeholders that need to know. So it all hinges really on what is this direction? And at the heart of any direction is really the fundamentals of any decision. Whether that's getting up and just making a cup of tea, or it's, you know, a whole complex, massive multinational organization, it's about being clear. What am I optimizing for? You know, what's the thing I'm trying to do? So an organization doesn't just exist. It exists because people have come together to achieve something. So what is the thing that, because otherwise you might as well pack up and go home. So what are you trying to achieve? But any decision to achieve something will be based, will be made within certain constraints, limitations. We can call these parameters, decision-making parameters. Those parameters can be things like the parameter to obey the law, which is a choice, let's face it. It could be your risk tolerance level. It could be how you want to treat people, your values, how much you think that the point at which you won't pay people less than a certain percentage. It could be the carbon emissions that you won't go above. So these are sort of guardrails for decision making. We call them decision making parameters. So the direction is making sure, especially now, if you're an individual making those decisions, you can be more fluid about how you do it. But if it's more than one person, you need to have, especially in large organizations, when you're out there making decisions continually, if people are not clear about what the objective is, and within what parameters, then basically you can't do strategy. So we talk about strategy a lot. It's thrown around in different ways and sort of used and abused, you might say. But really, strategy is actually quite simple. It's how do I achieve this objective within the parameters, given the dynamic context that I face? And that could be everything from what's our organization at the organizational level, you know, why, what do we exist for, within what parameters, and therefore what's the company-wide strategy for the next, you know, 1, 5, 10 years? Or it can be nested within that, because everything should be working together. So it could be strategy at a sub-department level. But ultimately, if you're not clear about your objective and your parameters, and those don't roll up in a nested way to the organization as a whole, then you do not have clear direction. And if you don't have clear direction, then you can't oversee as a governing body, which is the ultimate governance, you know, keeper, you might say, or custodian of that governance system. You can't oversee whether or not you have achieved the goal within the objective within the parameter, and you can't account for it. And so a lot of the issues that we face come down to that. And in the context of unsustainability, we can really clearly understand where we've gone wrong through that lens. So if we think about the fact that the economy, like Economics 101, says that an economy exists to take resources and transform them for essentially the well-being of the society that it serves, or the unit that it serves in the longer term. I mean, that is pretty much the essence, whichever way you cut it and wherever you cut it, is the ultimate objective. Now, that's usually like a paragraph, and then we move on to the rest. And the rest is a set of very specific assumptions about how we think we can organize the market economy in a way that best transforms and allocates those resources for that end goal. But we've become so sort of blind to alternatives, and so reliant and so trusting on these assumptions, that no one's been governing whether the goal of long-term well-being for all is being achieved or not, or being really clear about those parameters. So we've sort of outsourced all of the assumptions to this sort of system that we call the market economy. And now we've stopped even questioning if there's another way to organize it. And what that means is, ultimately, that we've assumed that the objective of business, and actually, I would say, of all organizations, is essentially self-interest, and it is financial self-interest, and that the parameters that we care most about in terms of counting, measuring, and disclosing about are the stocks and flows of financial capital. And that's what we regulate for. That's what we require the governance system to really focus on. So that means we're saying the innovation is ultimately there to make as much money as possible for that entity, that organization. And as long as you count the stocks and flows of financial capital, everything's good. Now, of course, what that misses out is the fact that the ultimate goal of long-term well-being for all is not, which, by the way, is also the definition of sustainability. In other words, we wouldn't have this. We wouldn't even have a term called sustainability if the economy was achieving the goal that it should be achieving. But we've got this term because it isn't. Because in focusing people on the objective of financial income, that is the where the investment case gets filtered through, and usually in the short term. And so the innovation is not how do we take these resources and make people's lives as good as possible, you know, equitably and in the long term. But also, we, in terms of the parameters, because we really just count stocks and flows of financial capital, the non-financial capital that actually underpins that financial capital, in other words, the natural inputs into an organization, the human, the social and intellectual, you know, we can use the five capitals model or the seven capitals model, people will know different ones. The point is that these kind of foundational capitals are very rarely counted. We've only in the last sort of 15, 20 years even started for some innovative organizations to start to do this multi-capital accounting, formalized, for example, through the Integrated Reporting Council, et cetera, et cetera. And now, and of course, also through ESG, saying, actually, we do want you to count these things, and we do want you to tell us about the stocks and flows. But also, under those capital inputs, of course, sit the social and environmental systems that are the, you know, the fundamental healthy climate, you know, enough fresh water for us all, ecosystems that function, social stability, trust in institutions. You know, these are the foundation of any activity in any organization. But we have assumed that both those, the non-financial capitals that result, and also the stakeholders that gatekeep all of that, we've just assumed that we can essentially do what we like, and those systems will be fine and healthy. So we don't measure whether they're healthy. We don't measure what we need to do to ensure they're healthy. And everyone's just expecting that someone else will sort it out. More than that, our assumption is that the law will sort that out. Because our assumption is that in a democracy, society will make its displeasure at externalities known through the political system, and therefore the law will change. Now, we can see what's happening with ESG when we even in a point of crisis, which we should never have got to if that system was working, we can see that the ability for people who have power within a system, because they have been able to capture that financial capital, are now able to use that and have been able to use that to stop those laws coming into place. So we really are stuck, but the reason we're stuck is pretty clear. We have an overall governance system that's focused on the wrong objective with the wrong parameters at an organizational level. And the government and nobody else has been checking whether the actual goal and the actual parameters are fit and healthy and working. And now we have our answer, of course, because if we run a system for 60, 70 years like that, then the consequences are going to come and bite you on the bum. And they are doing that, not just knocking at the door, but like steaming through the windows and every crack to the point that we can't ignore it. So I think governance can tell us both at that macro level, in other words, society as a whole, even not in a democracy, is the ultimate governing body. We then delegate to government to govern on our behalf. We have not been using the right goals or parameters in terms of direction, and we've not been overseeing government, and we have not been we've not been accountable to ourselves for whether that's happening. You get to that next level of government. Government has not had the right objectives or parameters to what they ostensibly should be there to do in our own best interest. And in turn, they've therefore the structures around governance that they put on organizations have also not been right. And it's based on a set of wrong assumptions about how the market works, how customers are able to know their own best interest. They are able to put their well-being first. And therefore, as long as you have enough competition in the marketplace and enough choice, then people will purchase their well-being. And the only thing that affects their ability to achieve well-being and increase it is financial income. And hence, we have this financialization that goes to the heart of governance, because we all assume that finance and financial income is a really good proxy for well-being. And therefore, GDP is focused on, because if GDP is going up, money can be put into the hands of citizens, who we now call consumers, who can purchase their well-being in the marketplace. And we citizens are told, this is what you need to focus on. Your life won't be great if you don't have as much money in your pocket to spend in the marketplace. We have marketized parts of our lives that used to be free. And we have told companies, just focus on your own profits and you're doing the best moral job that you can. So it's one big mess, but it's a clear mess when you really set it out. And that means we have clarity about how to move forwards, which means we need to alter the governance direction fundamentally. We need to do that in a nested way. And the work that I've been doing is drawing out that consensus, which I observed existed in one form or another globally, to say, yes, let's now make that clear. We need direction at all levels of the system, including in every organization, that is aligned, that the reason an organization exists and is allowed to access our resources is to transform them into something useful for collective long-term well-being. And that in delivering that purpose, that you can't destroy the basis of long-term well-being while doing it. So you have to prove you're doing no harm. And that's essentially the unfolding ESG agenda.
And so, Victoria, for any of our listeners who might be key decision makers in businesses, whether that's a tech business, a security business, any kind of medium to large scale business, you have their ear right now. They're listening to you, and probably they're wondering, What is one thing that you would like them to do now? If they're going to stop listening to this podcast, go away and take away one piece of information, do one tangible thing to help with this, what would you like them to do?
Go and look at the science. I think, I mean, there are lots of things that I could say. I would say question all your assumptions. Don't start from what you might have learned at business school, or even what, you know, we grew up with our parents telling us. We are at a point in humanity, the most incredible time to be alive. And if you're part of the 1%, which we, and I think everyone listening to this will be, in terms of education, power, access to making decisions, influence, you know, we undersell our power so much. If you are in a position of power, which you will be, at this moment in human history, this is the moment to step up, to go big, to go deep, to question what otherwise we could get away without questioning. And therefore, I would say go and look at the science as a starting point. So this is about everything. But one of the biggest differences I see between people who get it, you know, who start to make innovative strategic decisions that are actually commensurable with the situation that we find ourselves in, are those that are informed by the base science. So go to the UN, go to NASA, go to credible sources and look up things like biodiversity loss, like topsoil erosion, like water scarcity, like climate change, which is one of a suite of issues. Look at the Stockholm Institute's information on planetary boundaries. Do research into the social thresholds and breakdowns that we're seeing, and let that be your guide, because there's a lot of chaos out there. It can be easy for decision makers to get blindsided by trying to just keep up with the mess. And my message is always, so when I work with executives and organizations, it's to try to help them to cut through that so that they can see the direction of travel. And in that message that I give is always, you can be a futurist, despite how chaotic everything is. You can be a futurist or close to it if you understand the fundamental social and environmental systems, the degradation they've been subjected to over such a long period of time and where that's heading. Because we like to say, for example, ESG, oh yes, you know, will it go because it's political and the US is fighting back against it in certain quarters? I'm sorry, until we solve and heal our social and environmental systems, this is not going away anywhere, because we are not in the driving seat of this. We are in terms of resolving it, but in terms of the baked in issues that are also intersecting with each other, that is where the motivation and the clarity to move forward at greater speed and scale than feels and seems reasonable will come from. And I'll just summarize by saying there, I call that the real reality. So one of the fundamental issues of business as usual is we've created ourselves this very comfortable little box that we all live in, and we all verify to each other, like the emperor's new clothes, that this is fine and correct, and this is what's feasible and pragmatic. All the while, because of that, causing this chaos in the system around us that now we can't ignore. That's the real reality. And we're now at a crux point. Do we stay in this little box and keep pretending, well, we'd like to address that, but it's not just not feasible or pragmatic? I'm sorry, that is not the real feasible or pragmatic. The real feasible and pragmatic is sat outside the box. So my summary request would be, do what you can to elevate your thinking and understanding beyond the box that we've all been put in, because now is the moment to do it.
Incredible advice. And I really, really would urge all of our listeners to take that to heart. Thank you very much, Victoria. Very, very final question. I always like to end on a positive note if we can. Is there any piece of good news from your area of expertise you can think of that you would like to share? Anything that's sort of trending towards the positive that our listeners may not be aware of?
Yes, absolutely. So we talked a bit about the standards building, but I didn't mention the British standard in purpose-driven organizations, which is actually normatively, so it's aligned with ISO 37000, but it essentially sets out the governance and management behaviors of an organization that's fundamentally aligned with a sustainable future, both in terms of the objective that it exists for, but also doing no harm to the social and environmental systems, et cetera, while doing it. So that is the first draft. It's the first time globally that we have a national standard on purpose-driven organizations. And that is hopefully will go out for global vote and therefore may commence as an ISO process. In other words, what is the global view about what the governance and management behaviors that align an organization with a sustainable future, what that looks like. And if that happens, then I'll be leading that process, enabled by, you know, the bigger ISO leadership team and involving up to 167 countries. So that is something that involves all of us, like I say, because without that and having clarity about that, we won't have accountability. And if we don't have that clarity about the future we want to create in that level of detail, you know, what are the governance behaviors in an organization, then we are spending our energy going around in circles. So it's an invitation, a very positive invitation, to get involved in what would be a catalyst moment for the world. And you can prepare yourself for that by getting to know who your national member standards body is and getting involved there, but also downloading PAS 808, the British Standard in Purpose-Driven Organizations, that's freely available, and starting to work with it, be that at the worldviews level that are listed at the beginning, or like Anglian Water has done, auditing themselves twice from two different perspectives across the whole standard and working out how far away from being aligned with a sustainable future your organization or decisions are. So I think this is a source of great hope because, like I say, unless we can get to that level of specificity then and clarity about the future we want to build, I think hope is more difficult.
Incredible. Thank you, Victoria. What an excellent both ray of hope and a call to action there. Thank you so much for joining us on the show. I've really, really enjoyed speaking to you.
Thank you, Todd.
Thanks to Dr. Victoria Hirth for her time on the show, and thanks to you for listening. If you'd like to explore further reading around some of the subjects touched on in this interview, visit ceo.digital for the page connected to this episode. In particular, I'd recommend Dr. Hirth's 30-minute keynote on governance, sustainability, and quality, which can be found on YouTube. But I also highly recommend seeking out more information on ISO 37000 and PAS 808. In the meantime, be sure to like and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and keep an ear out for our next conversation about the subject of sustainable cloud. Until then, thanks for listening.